I'll call the meeting to order of the Senate State Government Finance Policy and Elections Committee, today being Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. Welcome everybody to the committee. Glad to have you here today. Good to see faces out there. Always appreciate that. At any rate, we're going to go get started. I'm going to have Ms. Wilson call the roll.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Present.
Senator Howe.
Present.
Senator Carlson. Senator Clausen.
Present.
Senator Fateh. Senator Curran.
Present.
Senator Pratt. Senator Osmick.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. We do have a quorum. With that, we're going to go ahead and get to our first bill here. We have Senator Dreheim, and I will move Senate File 295, Senator Dreheim. Welcome to the committee. When you're ready, go ahead, name and so on for the audio, and then present your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Dreheim, Rich Dreheim here, talking about Senate File 295. Senate File 295 is trying to move licensing for radon activities from Minnesota Department of Health to DALI. Why am I trying to do this? Almost all activities for building are overseen by the Department of Labor and Industry. And what is a radon mitigation system? To be simple, it's putting a basket underneath the slab of a home with PVC pipe running up through the roof. And then that's a passive system. Put an active system, and this is very simplifying it. They put an outlet in the attic and put a little blower in it to help suck the air out from underneath the slab, get the gas out through the roof line. Very similar to other activities that are done in construction. And if you look at DALI's homepage, the Construction Code and License Division provides for regulation and enforcement of construction-related health and safety codes and licensing law in new and existing structures. I think this is the best fit for our oversight in this industry. Plain and simple. On my way down to this hearing room, I received an email from Ms. James. Thank you very much for that email. And I, if it's okay with you, Chair Kiffmeyer, I would like to go to them and kind of just touch on one of the issues that came up at the last hearing in labor and industry. And that was to do with rulemaking and shifting rulemaking from MDH to DALI. And if I could call on Ms. James, Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, the fiscal note shows that there would be a cost related to rulemaking for DALI. In my opinion, it's not necessary for DALI to engage in full rulemaking. Under Minnesota statute section 15.039, rules, when responsibilities are transferred from one agency to another, the rules go with it along with the rulemaking authority. So the existing rules will transfer over to DALI, and DALI will then have the responsibility to enforce those rules, but they won't have to make those rules.
Thank you, Ms. James. So I think this may have a fiscal impact. So Mr. Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the changes that Ms. James is describing are currently described in a table near the bottom of page 7. It looks like the department is counting about $310,000 for a major rulemaking event related to the transfer of responsibilities. If you're looking at the bottom table on that page, it's the fifth item down. Given what Ms. James has expressed, I think that the agency wouldn't need that. Now, that said, that's outside of the state gov's jurisdiction specifically as far as where these appropriations are going, and the appropriations in the bill are currently blank on pages 2 and 3 of the bill. I'd expect those to be filled in finance, and I think the fiscal analyst who covers these areas will probably be able to fix those appropriations for finance. But it does seem that the appropriation for rulemaking would be unnecessary.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. I would agree with that. And so that would reduce the fiscal note significantly for your bill, Senator Draheim, which would be good news. As a result of that, do you have any other testifiers at this time?
We do, Chair. I think there's three testifiers listed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go ahead and go with your testifiers then. We have Mr. Angel from the University of Minnesota, and he's testifying remote. So, Mr. Angel, would you please come on camera and state your name and your title for the audio record, and then proceed to your testimony. Oh, there you are. Okay. Welcome.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Professor Angel, and Professor Emeritus, University of Minnesota. I've had a 47-year career with the university, in that time focusing on building science. I've had the opportunity to work with both Dolly and the Minnesota Department of Health. The last 30 years of my career have been focused on radon. I'm familiar with state radon programs nationally, as well as at the federal level and internationally. I ask you to not support this bill respectfully. Dolly and local building inspectors simply lack the technical focus and expertise to administer the breadth of Minnesota's radiation and health-based radon program. In fact, the radon program within MDH is a parallel pillar with the radiation control program, and that synergy is extremely important. We find nearly all state radon programs are administered by state health departments. No state radon program in the U.S. is administered by a building code and licensing division. National and state professional associations, including the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists, its chapter in Minnesota, the North Star chapter of ARS, as well as Cancer Survivors Against Radon. And I've been president or chairman of the board of all three organizations, have been consistent in their support of the radon program in the Minnesota Department of Health. The radon program within the Department of Health is nationally respected. It's admired for its consultative approach to working with the industry for radiation protection through radon control in buildings. That includes existing buildings and the new construction portions in Dolly, where it should be. But the existing building, the measurement side of the radon program, and the quality assurance and quality control, it's very important that it remains within MDH. I'd be happy to answer any questions you or members of the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Angel. Appreciate your testimony today. We'll go to the next testifier. Oh, I'm sorry, there is a question here. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Angel. So I understand that it's important to have Department of Health maybe involved, but with your background, do you know who would be approving and who would be inspecting the installation of not only new systems, but also those that would be remodeled to go into an existing residence? Who would do the inspections of those, and who would be the oversight department of that?
Mr. Angel.
Senator Howell, Madam Chair, Senator Howell, and members. already the new construction code is in Dolly. That is appropriate, and that's been supported by MDH throughout the process. What we're talking about are the other elements of the radiation control protection program, which are radon mitigation in existing homes. Some local units of government inspect, but many do not. And that's the reason the program is under MDH and its oversight. It's also integrated with radon measurement and diagnostic procedures both before and after mitigation. So it's very important that those elements stay together. And those, once again, I believe are appropriate in MDH. Thank you.
Senator Hall?
Well, Madam Chair, as a building official in my other life here, as I in my other job, I end up having to actually inspect those systems to make sure that they're installed properly and function appropriately. So, and I have contacted the Department of Labor and Industry. I've never contacted the Minnesota Department of Health in that process. I just wanted to make sure that people are clear on, and I have my certification through the Department of Labor and Industry, not through the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Holland. That's very helpful to know that. With that, thank you, Mr. Angel. We'll proceed to next testifier, Mr. Nick Erickson. And again, just state your name for the audio record and your title or who you're representing, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm the Director of Research and Regulatory Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate File 295. Comprehensive housing policy reform requires challenging the status quo, and whenever you have a bill here in the Senate, that is doing just that, you're going to find Senator Dreheim's name attached to that bill. Today, in Minnesota, building a new home or remodeling a home can involve interaction with at least 10 agencies at some level, state, local, federal. And what this bill does, it takes one step out of that process. And as Senator Dreheim noted, as well as Senator Howe, this makes a lot of sense. When you look at what radon mitigation is, it is essentially a prescriptive construction methodology. That does work, really fall under the jurisdiction of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry's Construction Codes Advisory Council. Mitigation contractors are themselves building contractors. Again, that is something under the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry's purview. And as Senator Howe noted, building officials are also under DLI. Well, there's a provision on the testing side where if you are doing radon testing, you do not need to fall under the certification of Minnesota Department of Health if you are a building official. So really this does make a lot of sense. And there's some past issues that we've done here in Minnesota to shift other regulations from the agencies to DLI, notably the energy code. That used to be within the Department of Commerce. So we do have a history in the state of shifting building and, you know, construction regulations from one agency to another, and that agency is always DLI that is going to be taking those regulations. We're doing this now on stormwater as well, trying to shift multiple overlapping state agencies and shift that into one singular program. This is good governance. It makes things easier for all stakeholders. So I'll be brief. I just want to close by stating I work with a lot of state agencies and regulatory bodies across the state when it comes to housing policies. And the Department of Labor and Industry is the gold standard. We use that at Housing First Minnesota as, you know, how all state agencies should approach housing policymaking. And that is engagement with stakeholders, open, responsive staff, listening to what all stakeholders have to say. And this program fits well within that framework. So if it were to transfer to DLI. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Erickson. Okay, we're going to go ahead then to seeing no questions for this particular testifier at this time. We'll go ahead to our next testifier, Assistant Commissioner Mr. Huff.
Oh, wow.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Huff. I'm an Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Health. I wanted to talk some about, you know, why is this program at MDH? But MDH focuses on environmental health hazard abatement and mitigation. Building code enforcement ensures work is conducted by standards outlined in code, or as Mr. Erickson just described, is prescriptive work. Health hazard abatement and mitigation, however, is based upon properly abating and mitigating or removing a health hazard. So effective lead hazard abatement and radon mitigation are based upon measuring what level the hazard is before the mitigation, and then what is the level of the hazard after the mitigation. That measure is important. This work is done in existing homes. That's very different than new construction. So radon, for example, at its outset, seems very simple. You, as Senator Graham said, you put a basket in the floor, you put a pipe in a fan. But what is under that slab? That can vary greatly in old construction, and that's why that post-measurement is so important. Did the mitigation work? So another difference is the acute versus chronic nature of health and safety hazards. Unlike faulty wiring or bad plumbing, lead, asbestos, and radon health impacts may take many years to manifest. It may take years for someone to develop lung cancer from radon. MDH's health hazard mitigation and abatement programs are housed in our indoor environments and radiation section. This section includes X-ray, so inspecting all X-ray machines in the state, radioactive materials, which includes healthcare radioactive waste, as well as monitoring our two nuclear power plants, asbestos and lead. We do license asbestos contractors as well as lead abatement contractors. Our environmental lab accreditation, and then our indoor air unit. Radon is housed within our indoor air unit. This unit enforces the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act. It enforces the statutes related to air quality in ice arenas and motorsports. It also receives federal grants to conduct radon education, outreach, and research, and finally conducts the radon licensing program. When we look at efficiency and how do we get to make sure that we have supporting programs, it makes sense that radon, which is an environmental health hazard, takes many years to manifest itself, is complicated in its mitigation and requires pre and post assessment. It makes sense that our specialists who specialize in radiation science, radon is a radioactive gas, who focus in other environmental health abatements, such as asbestos and lead, who accreditate the environmental labs who are charged with actually doing the measurement and confirming the measurements, as well as our other indoor air programs. I also want to address some comments that were raised in the last hearing. Senator Drayton, you had raised concerns about how MDH enforces this statute, and I just want to rest assured that my expectation, Commissioner Malcolm's expectation, is that all MDH staff show professional and respectful behavior as they interact with the public and our customers. Now, it's unclear to me if the concerns that were raised relate to the behavior of MDH staff or just general frustration with the regulatory program. I have not received any complaints regarding staff's professionalism or respectful nature of working with our customers or the public. But please urge anyone, if you do have a concern, reach out to me or reach out to the department. Now, if it is indeed about the regulatory program, well, that is based upon our rules that were developed through a very inclusive stakeholder process, but derive out of state statute. So that would be a state statute issue around the radon mitigation itself. We believe at MDH that this is the appropriate place. It is complicated. It is complex. New construction is very different than existing construction. Health hazard mitigation requires pre- and post-technical measurement. It can be tricky. We provide a lot of technical advice. We provide training. We did over 15 trainings last year on radon mitigation. It is our goal to make sure that health hazards are abated. The original intent of this statute was to protect homeowners who had paid for mitigation systems that met the, I guess, the prescriptive code requirements, but failed at actually mitigating the hazard, exposing and continuing to expose residents who had paid for the mitigation to radioactive and carcinogen gas. So that's really the purpose. We believe it best is suited in MDH, where we can provide both the TA, the technical support, and the other scientific support provided. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoff. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Kiffmeyer. Members, we're not changing the guidelines around radon. We are closer? I'm sorry. We're not changing the standards for radon. We're not changing the testing for radon. We are using the federal guidelines for radon. As far as the technical ability of the industry to deal with radon is not being changed. It'll be the same people installing the radon systems with Department of Labor overseeing the program or MDH overseeing the program. It's the same federal guidelines. It's the same products. Everything is the same. It's just streamlining who oversees the program. I am not suggesting that MDH not do research on air quality, but we don't really have something special for carbon monoxide gas or natural gas leaks. It's all within Dolly. It's all with the contractors working to ensure that we have a safe place to live. I think it's just common sense, Bill, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. I have a question for you, Mr. Huff. My question to you would be, would it be your intention or the intention of the Minnesota Department of Health that if this responsibility is laid out in 295, Senate file, would be moved to Dolly, that you would end your research on radon, Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, we conduct these outreach programs and research programs under a federal grant with the U.S. EPA. We would need to determine, you know, one of the advantages right now is all of these programs are housed in the same room, so we can provide all the technical system that actually is much more cost effective. A lot of the technical systems that we provide to our contractors after we inspect is free due to our federal grant. While we would still conduct those activities, we would not conduct them based upon our inspection. It would be just general outreach and general education. It would be up to DLI to do the specific education and technical assistance for the contractors that are installing this. And I assume that would add an additional cost, where cost right now is paid for by our EPA.
Thank you, Mr. Huff. I think it was a rather straightforward question, but that you get grants from the federal government and then you do your research on the basis and funded by those grants. And I would expect also, Mr. Huff, that the Department of Health and the Department of Labor and Industry on occasion do talk to one another, communicate information, communicate data files, and other kinds of things that would be helpful to you in the Department of Health. With that, I will go to Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question for Mr. Huff. I'm curious, how many years has the Department of Health had radon analysis, radon mitigation as part of their responsibility.
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Senator Fossen, we have the radon licensing and inspection program was determined in statute, and I believe it was 2017-2016. Rulemaking condensed after that, and we began really rolling out the program, I believe it was in 2019. We have been doing years of work on radon. We serve as technical assistant. When a resident calls, for example, to say, what do I do? I have radon in my house. We provide that technical assistance to the homeowner. If a contractor calls, we have provided that. I will have to get back to you on when we started that work. I know that it's been going just from my previous work when I was at the city of Minneapolis. MDH provided great support for us at the city around radon for any questions our residents had, as well as any questions around support for education and as well as testing. I'll have to figure out exactly when MDH started that work. I just know it definitely was during my 13 years in the city of Minneapolis, MDH was great.
Thank you, Mr. Huff.
We'll get back.
Senator Carls, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up question. During the time, excuse me, that this responsibility has been with the Department of Health, has there ever been discussion or concern about the lines of responsibility? Have there ever been complaints, issues about the current situation, about the division, let's say, of radon responsibilities between the two departments?
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Senator Fossen, we have heard concern around the regulation itself. The department was actually sued to prevent enforcement of the statute. Now, our job in the executive branch, obviously, is to enforce the statutes written by the legislature. That case was dismissed in MDH's favor. So we've definitely had concern and, I would say, pushback from folks who disagree with the legislation. But I do not know of concerns about the difference in whether it's regulated by MDH or DLI. Obviously, we do work with our partners in DLI. One of the things that is tricky when we work with our partners, any enforcement action is actually protected, and we do not share, unless there's an interagency agreement signed by both commissioners, we don't actually share enforcement action that is undergoing until that work is completed. Same thing, I don't want to speak for DLI, but that's my experience as well, because an agency is responsible for its own data privacy, if you will. And it would be inappropriate to share that, hey, we have enforcement action pending. Or it would be inappropriate for DLI to share that with us and say, we asked you to provide technical assistance on this having trouble. By having it in one shot, we can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Huff. I think you have a little problem with your audio there, but Senator Clausen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No other questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Huff, how many of these, how many radon inspectors do you have on staff that actually go out and look at these installations?
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, I don't have that number on me. I'll see if my staff can text it to me real fast. Otherwise, we'll have to follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Huff.
For the record, I did ask for some information from the last hearing last month, and I haven't received it from the agency.
I'm sorry, what was that again,
Senator? I had asked for some information from Assistant Commissioner Huff last month at the hearing. I had never received that information, so I hope the information that Senator Howe is requesting is in a more timely fashion than the information that I asked for in the last hearing.
Senator Durantime, this is Lisa Timian-Lunn.
Just a moment. Who is that on the phone right now or online or whatever? Please do not start speaking. Do not start speaking until you have been recognized. Okay. Mr. Huff, we have a question from Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as long as they're going to get that information as how many inspectors they have, I'd also like to know how many inspections they've completed or how many they do about on the average annually. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Huff. Thank you, Senator Howe. And Mr. Huff, question for you then is the number of inspectors that should be readily available. Either you or your staff will be here in the committee for a few minutes. So we have another testifier, if you could get that information while we're yet on this bill, and I'll come back to you, Mr. Huff. Okay, with that, I will go to our next testifier, Mr. Durenberger with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Welcome. And when you come on camera, state your name for the audio record and then proceed to your testimony. Mr. Durenberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Durenberger. I'm an assistant director in DLI's Construction Codes and Licensing Division. I manage our licensing and our enforcement units. And I'd just like to echo what Dr. Angel said, that radon mitigation is much more complicated an issue than simply sticking a pipe into the foundation and venting it up through the roof. And the installation of these systems in existing homes does require measurement of the radon before the installation and after the installation. And in fact, the vast majority of the number of licensees that MDH has in the radon area, over 400 of them, are individuals who are responsible for doing this testing. And DLI simply does not have the expertise or the staff to review the qualifications of individuals who may do this measurement and analysis of the presence of radon, which is going to be a large part of the licensing program and the rest of the functions that would transfer from MDH to DLI. Of those licensees, only 41 are actually mitigation contractors that do mitigation work characterized as just basically contractor work. So we're talking about a very small population of contractors compared to a large population of individuals who are doing work that really is not construction related. It's scientific work. It's related to the collection of and measurement and analysis of the presence of radon gas. So we believe that expertise it clearly exists at MDH, and they have a unified program of the review of licenses, the collection of data, the inspection, the enforcement activity, and moving all of that to another agency that lacks the same type of experience and expertise as it relates to the scientific side of radon measurement, the benefits simply aren't there to justify the cost and the disruption of doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Durenberger. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have several questions here. Mr. Durenberger, you talked about the expertise of the staff, and the fiscal note says there's 1.75 FTE assigned to that would be impacted by transferring regulation to DLI. In your part of the fiscal note, I don't see any recognition of transfer of those staff. Are we just assuming that those staff are gone, or is it reasonable that those staff would move over with their expertise into your agency?
Mr. Durenberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, it's my understanding that the staff would not transfer, and that we would basically have to create the staff or educate staff and train them to provide this function of advising not only mitigation professionals but also consumers, building officials, and others as it relates to every aspect of radon mitigation and measurement.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the beginning of the hearing, Ms. James questioned your fiscal note and the expenses for rulemaking. Could you please describe why you couldn't just adopt the existing rules?
Mr. Durenberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, it was our understanding from the way the bill was written where the very first line of the bill says the Commissioner of Labor and Industry shall adopt rules establishing licensure requirements. So our understanding was that, and it also, the bill also deletes out MDH's rulemaking authority. So it was that the clear language of the bill required us to actually do rulemaking.
Senator Pratt, just a moment. Ms. James, if you could comment on that issue. Ms. James is a general counsel for the committee.
Madam Chair, members, under 15.039, again, it provides that all rules adopted pursuant to responsibilities that are transferred to another agency remain effective and shall be enforced. This first section of the bill merely changes the name of the commissioner who has the responsibilities for rulemaking. It's not a direction necessarily to adopt new rules. It is just a clerical change of the existing statute.
Thank you, Ms. James. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Ms. James. She helped me out with something here. Going back to the transfer personnel, Mr. Durnberger, statute 15.039 subdivision 7 says all classified and unclassified positions associated with responsibilities being transferred are transferred with their incumbents to the new agency. Can you explain to me why we would not be able to transfer our experienced personnel over to DLI from MDH?
Mr. Durnberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I wasn't aware of that provision of Chapter 15 that allowed for that transfer, but I would comment that, that we're talking about transferring staff from one agency to another. There's a certainly, I'm certain, an infrastructure within the Department of Health that allows for plenty of support for all of the people that work in radon and indoor health division over there. So to pull just a few of them out and bring them to labor and industry, I'm assuming that they would have to continue to consult back and forth with their colleagues at the Department of Health, because there's just nobody at labor and industry that can provide the support with respect to the issues that are specific to radon and separate from all of the other code construction issues that DLI and CCLD work with.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Durnberger, we have guidelines, regulations on the amount of lead that can be in drinking water, and MDH sets those standards. Yet the work being done is managed through the plumbing code in DLI. Are you telling me that there's no communication in lead and drinking water between DLI staff and MDH staff, that you have to work in a silo?
Mr. Durnberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, no, not at all. But I think there's a big difference between the installation of plumbing and the installation of a radon mitigation system. When a plumber installs plumbing in a home, they're not required to take measurements of the amount of lead that's in the water going into the home or leaving the home. And that's the big difference. With a radon mitigation system, there is a requirement that the amount of radon present before the installation of the system is installed is done, and that measurements are taken afterward as well. And that simply doesn't exist with plumbing.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are you saying your 1.75 is the MDH 1.75 FTE going out to every home in the state and doing the measurement, or is that being trained and outsourced to contractors or other officials?
Mr. Durnberger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, to be honest with you, I'm not that familiar with exactly how MDH assures that these measurements are taken. I certainly don't have enough inspectors to go out and inspect every single installation, but that's not something that the Department of Labor and Industry would do either.
Thank you, Mr. Durnberger. Senator Pratt? Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just a closing comment is, there's been conflicting information from the agencies today that, you know, we couldn't transfer people, that we had to adopt new rules, when certainly we have rules that could be existing rules that could be easily adopted by DLI. What we've heard is that we do some health mitigation, we do air quality mitigation, we do drinking water guidelines. MDH sets the standard, DLI enforces the code. I think Senator Howe raised one of the key questions is that it becomes confusing to have our building codes existing in two different agencies. And I don't see how we can do drinking water and air quality coordination between DLI and MDH, but for some reason we can't seem to make that work with radon. I just don't see the difference between allowing a contractor to install a radon mitigation system in a new home under new construction, but people who are experienced in doing reconstruction don't have the ability to put in the pipes and the fans and have it checked out by someone who's already been qualified by MDH to do those measurements. So, Madam Chair, I support Senator Dreheim's bill, and maybe there are some clarifications that we have to make to ensure that we get the fiscal note in the order that we want it before it gets to finance. But I've not been swayed by any of the arguments by either MDH or DLI as far as why this needs to stay.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Just to know that this is going to go to Health and Human Services next. And yes, this fiscal note will need to be addressed in some of the issues brought up today and certainly clarified. I want to reiterate again in regards to the rules. It's a titling of who has responsibility for those rules, according to Ms. James. So once that is the case, the title will be Labor and Industry Rules instead of Department of Health Rules in regards to this radon. So this is really not so complicated or so difficult. In the meantime, rules as is stay there. Any future things become a responsibility of Dolly, but at this stage, things moved over. All those things will be staying the same. We have another, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think we need to recognize, first of all, that radon is a health issue. And through all the testimony today, I've not heard a compelling reason or a pressing reason why this change is needed. I haven't heard any testimony about we have some imminent health concerns with some of our citizens in Minnesota because the way things are currently being handled. There hasn't been really a good argument presented about why this change is really needed other than, well, maybe it belongs better in this particular State Department, but our agency. I guess for those reasons, I'll be voting no, but I just haven't heard any compelling reason why this change is really needed.
Thank you very much, Senator Clausen. Senator Dreheim, I'm going to call on Mr. Huff to have some of the answers to our questions. So, Mr. Huff, if you could respond with those answers. Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to gather those answers for you. And Senator Dreheim, apologies for the delay in responding to your questions from last time. I think we've just sent those, but we apologize for that. One of the questions, I believe, was from Senator Clausen. When did we start working in radon? We've been working in radon for 30 years, and we started regulating under the new statute on January 1st. Of 2019. We have two inspectors and one measurement auditor that are focused on the enforcement of the radon statute. Now, that does not include the staff that are ancillary. We have an administrative staff, for example. We have a supervisor of that unit. And then we have other professionals in radioactive science as well as other air quality professionals. We have done 140 mitigation systems inspections per year on average, and we do about 140 measurement professionals audits per year. To clarify, I think Senator Pratt, you had asked a question of Mr. Durenberger. We have measurement professionals that are licensed to do the measurements. We also do accreditation of the labs where those samples are taken. So we license and audit those measurement professionals as well as the mitigation professionals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Huff. Senator Dreheim, did that get your questions answered from a month ago?
Partially. I asked for a complete list of employees that were in this field.
Okay.
And I think there's some overlap there. But, we're good governance is what this bill's about. Where does this belong? If we're not going to fix it, who's going to fix it? And the science doesn't change. The people that do the inspections don't change. So I have never seen Minnesota Department of Health on any mitigation site, and I've been probably close to 100 of them. I've never seen them there, never talked to anybody that actually had them there. So I know in my area, South Central Minnesota, they're not coming out there. That doesn't mean they don't do it in other parts of the state. Safety, I'm all for it, but this is what the building professionals do, and Dolly oversees them. It's just a natural fit, and hopefully we'll continue on with our strong radon program no matter who houses it, because we have professionals that work for the state of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. Senator Howe?
One short comment. I just think you kind of missed the one thing in your bill. I think you should add lead to it too and move both products over to the, because when they fill out the building permit to remodel a home, the question is on there, was it built before 1978? If it was built before 1978, where's your lead certification? And that's who checks that? Us building officials check that. So I think you should move lead over there with it, but I support your bill. I think it's a common sense approach.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. I appreciate your bill because I think for those who do this work, those who are out in the homes and the houses, contractors, builders, all of that, what really makes things more successful for them is when it's housed within one agency. So there's one place to go to for those kinds of things, and I think that makes probably the biggest determining reason for doing this. With that, members, we'll proceed. And this bill, I will move Senate File 295 to be recommended to pass and to be referred to Health and Human Services. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and Senate File 295, you're on your way to Health and Human Services. Thank you, Senator Dreheim.
And members, thank you.
Okay, with that, we're going to go to Senate File 3407. Senator Howe, would you take care of the motions for Senator Duckworth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move Senate File 3407 to be in front of the committee, and I see he has an A1 amendment.
I do.
Thank you, Senator Duckworth. Thank you, Senator Howe. Senator Duckworth, do you have an amendment? Okay, Senator Howe.
I'll move the A1 amendment, if that's what you're looking for.
Author's amendment, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. First committee, author's amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to Senate File 3407, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Duckworth, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Howe and other members of the committee. This bill is fairly simple. It would allow the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission to partner with the cities of Eagan and Invergrove Heights to study the development of the United States Amateur Sports and Training Center in Dakota County. It would appropriate $750,000 in fiscal year 2023 from the general fund to the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission for the purposes of the study and the report. I have some folks with me here to testify today to share with you more about what this project could look like, and we'll start with Commissioner Atkins, if you would come on up here and join me.
Welcome, Commissioner Atkins and former state representative. Glad to have you here today.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and I told you I wore a tie as a former
you
House
can't
member,
get in the door without it.
It's nice
but
to
welcome.
See you. And thank you, Senator Duckworth, for authoring this legislation. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing it. Members of the committee, nice to see you. And staff, thanks for your help in getting us here. This, I told the chair before we got underway, we thought about proposing this as the Field of Dreams movie, if you're familiar with that. Just build it and they'll come. We'd come here, ask you for $30 million or $50 million. but we know that this group and this chief author are a little bit more business savvy than that. It's best to have a business plan, a feasibility study, know precisely what it is that we're looking for and whether or not it can be effective and efficient and operate well. So with that, the request was for the support of this committee for that study to be done. The National Sports Center in Blaine, as you know, is this committee has oversight authority, funding authority with respect to the Amateur Sports Commission, is $104 million in economic activity, 4 million visitors per year. This is not designed to supplant, but rather to supplement the National Sports Center. We are already in a position in Minnesota where we're at the forefront of amateur sports, youth sports, and the economic activity, all of the great things that come along with that. There is room, based on what we're hearing, for an additional facility. We've got in Dakota County the land, the demand, the operations, and the location, as well as the local support. What I mean by that, when we talk about land, there's availability of land. It's an unrivaled location, 10 minutes from the airport, 15 minutes from the Mall of America, 12 minutes south here of the state capitol, at the intersection of two highways or freeways, 35E and 494. So it's a terrific location, thousands of acres available in that part of the county. The demand, as soon as word got out that this was even being talked about, we've heard from volleyball, we've heard from basketball, we've heard from swimming, we've heard from bicycling, any number of other folks. We knew that demand was there before, but when there was publication of this, I believe in April of 2021, the wheels came off. It was just amazing the level of demand that's there, but before we were to proceed with that, we want to ensure that that can be verified through professionals that do this for a living and can tell us and verify that the demand is there to support a facility of this significance. With that, I should also note the on the operational side, you won't find anybody better than the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission when it comes to operating facilities like this. By the way, I should note I'm both on the Dakota County Board and the Amateur Sports Commission. I'm not speaking in an official role on behalf of either body. Like you, we want to make sure that it's a viable use, that it's feasible, that it'll work. And that's why we wanted to make sure that we walked before we ran. We appreciate Senator Duckworth putting this bill before you. We're joined here by the two local mayors who can speak to the land and the location issues and the demand that they're hearing. And with that, Senator Duckworth, thank you. Members, thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions, but I want to turn it over to the local mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Atkins. With that, we'll go to our next two testifiers. As a matter of fact, both mayors, you could both come on up. And so we have Mayor McGuire, Mayor of Eagan, and we have Mayor Bartholomew from Invergrove Heights. When you're ready, state your name and title for the audio record, then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike McGuire. I'm the mayor of the city of Eagan. I appreciate you having me here today and the opportunity to testify this morning in support of Senate File 3407, funding for the study of the feasibility of an amateur sports complex in the South Metro. I also want to say hello to my state senator, Jim Carlson, as well. I'm joined today by our city's director of Parks and Recreation, Andrew Pimentel, and pleased to join with my mayoral colleague from Invergrove Heights, and Joe Atkins in support of the bill. I'd also like to thank Senator Duckworth from Lakeville for authoring the bill as well. Even at the early stage of concept and vision, I think the diverse collection of individuals who have encouraged this feasibility study speaks to the regional value of the project and the regional value that it might have to provide in the South Metro and the state in terms of economic impact and a complement to our statewide amateur sports environment. While I'll talk about Eagan a little bit, I assure you I am not here today as an advocate for my city, but instead for our region of the state and the youth and adult amateur athletes in the South Metro. Eagan is a community of just under 70,000 residents and over 2,300 businesses. We are the second largest city in Dakota County. I'm sure Senator Duckworth would be more than happy to tell you what the largest city in Dakota County is. Eagan is a community, part of our success in Eagan has been to continually plan for and anticipate our community's needs for the future. Almost a decade ago, we developed a comprehensive parks master plan, and more recently, Andrew led a forward-looking comprehensive facility study, where we engaged our community broadly to identify future and emerging park programming and facility needs. What we found is that in our community, our community has increasingly broad demands for more diverse local and youth athletic programming and facilities. Specifically, we found that compared to national standards, we have a shortage of indoor court spaces, and we can't meet the space needs for sports like basketball, volleyball, and other emerging court sports. Many communities are similar in this way and have similar challenges with respect to the constant pursuit of ice time. And in Eagan, we are no different in regard to these communities and others in the region. The cost of such facilities for individual communities can be prohibitive and fiscally inefficient. However, when communities partner and collaborate, they can not only serve their collective local and regional needs, but also become a statewide and national draw for training and tournament events that help to fund the operations needed for the complexes. In addition, studies show that these centers and spaces can be a catalyst for regional business and the hospitality industry. Eagan and the South Metro region are increasingly becoming destination communities, and with proximity to the MSP Airport, the Mall of America, Vikings Lakes development surrounding the Vikings Lakes, the Vikings practice facility, I believe that much of the infrastructure needed to support a successful amateur sports facility is in place. The feasibility study of this legislation will help us in the region who sense a need and an opportunity to work with the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission to more deeply evaluate regional needs that are currently underserved, identify public and private community partners and clients, and develop a financially feasible operation plan. Madam Chair, committee members, again, I want to thank you for your time and consideration, and Andrew and I are happy to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mayor McGuire. Mayor Bartholomew, did you have additional comments?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. Committee members, thank you. I'm not going to go into great detail. We've heard from the Mr. Atkins and Mayor McGuire. I'm in complete agreement with what they've said. I will add just a couple of things. We agree that there is a need. I think the amateur sports facility would be an ideal fit. It would help regionally and locally. We have land. We've worked many times with the city of Eagan in partnership. We look forward to an opportunity, and we look forward to what the study will show us and the need and what we would need. So I would support the Senate file 3407, and I thank Mr. Senator Duckworth for bringing it forward and inviting us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I will note that's a pretty hefty price tag here, $750,000 for a study. Could you comment on what you would use that money for, how you would use it?
Excuse me, Madam Chair. The study will tell us how we can pay for it, how it pays for itself. We look for it to be self-sustaining. We look for it to drive us in our decision-making on what kind of sports would be supported, where the need is, and if in fact we do have the infrastructure that would support it and where we would put it.
Madam Chair, if I can add.
Mayor McGuire.
Agreed that it's a hefty price tag. I think we would look to the Minnesota Amateur Sports Association or Commission to really guide how that money is used and how that study is funded. The fact of the matter is that Mayor Bartholomew and I are not very experienced in administering these kinds of feasibility studies for these kinds of projects, and would really rely on the professional expertise of the Sports Commission to set out the parameters of the study in addition to legislation as well.
Okay, I see here that so the study would require the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission partner with your two cities to do this study is what I see here. So what you're saying, you'd rely upon them for their advice and expertise. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Sure, that's correct.
All right, still a hefty price tag. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Senator Duckworth for bringing this bill. And
Commissioner Atkins, thank you for supporting it and your service on the Amateur Sports Commission. You know, we've seen what an asset to the region that the Blaine Sports Center has provided. I mean, we've got, I can't tell you how many times I drove up there for soccer tournaments and the ability that not only play teams from the region, but, you know, the Schwann's Cup brings in international teams that bring a lot of tourism and exposure to the Twin Cities. And is two of the fastest growing areas in the state, Dakota County and Scott County both. Senator Duckworth, my first question, and maybe Commissioner, is, has there been any coordination with Scott County and looking at land, say, in Credit River or any of the other areas where we would need a vast amount of land in order to be able to do this? And then, Madam Chair, I'll have a follow-up question.
Okay. Sure. Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take an initial stab at that question while the Commissioner gets up here to shed some light on it as well. But your point is well taken. As a fellow senator from the South Metro, I could understand why that would be important to you and your constituents as well as mine. The largest city in Dakota County was alluded to earlier. I happen to live there, the great city of Lakeville. So your point's well taken. It would be wise to maybe give some other areas some consideration as well. I'll let the commissioner elaborate on any conversations that may or may have not taken place.
Thank you, Senator Duckworth. Commissioner Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, appreciate the question. Big fan of Scott County. Bigger fan of Dakota County for obvious reasons. The issue really, quite honestly, was the proximity of the airport, that 10 to 15 minute, and I don't know, quite honestly, if you can get to Scott County in 10 to 15 minutes from the airport, perhaps you can, but it's not necessarily, from an amateur sports commissioner standpoint, I'm agnostic on with respect to that as much as it is driven by the location of the airport.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'll put your concerns to rest, Commissioner Atkins. Credit River, Minnesota's newest city that Senator Duckworth will soon inherit from me, is very close to 35W, and in fact is near the, it also is next to the 35W-35E split. So I can tell you we do have good access. My other question would be, $750,000 for the study. If this weren't to include Scott County as part of the partnership, what local resources, what local financial contribution is Dakota County or the city's making as part of this study, or are you expecting the state to pay for the entire study?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question, Senator. The study is being, the requested funding for the study is being requested from the state without a local match. It is, you'll note, I forget which section it is, but there was one of the pieces of the legislation would look for potential local support for the construction of the facility. And I don't know whether that would be cities, counties. Ideally, it would be someone from the private community. You alluded to the Schwann's Cup earlier. There's plenty of opportunities, and by the way, it's Target Cup now, but there seem to be plenty of opportunities for partnership with the private community as well.
Okay. Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pratt, just to let you know, we could build on the Dan Patch Corridor a rail line to get you home in 15 minutes if you wanted to. And you are on transportation with Senator Kiffmeyer, so we could make that happen for you.
Senator Osmek, I can get you the bill if you're interested in offering it.
Senator Pratt, I'll pass.
Thank you very much, members. Senator Carlson, I'll call on you first, and then Senator Clausen, since it's your first time as Senator Clausen is.
Yeah. I'm Carlson, he's Clausen.
I could call you Senator Carlson. Mm-hmm.
I just want to express my support for this. This, you know, the city of Eagan has been very well managed over the years, and I think this is something that would be a great addition to our area. We are always hearing about the shortage of ice sheets, the shortage of time, the golf, you know, you name it. There's a lot of amateur sports that there's a big demand in the South Metro, and I think that this would certainly help round out Eagan as a location and a destination. So I really appreciate this bill coming forward, and thank you, Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll repeat that my six grandkids, I drive all over the metro area to various ice arenas, and like Senator Pratt, I've driven up to the Blaine facility on more than one occasion. So this is something that definitely is needed. It'd be a real asset. Similar to Senator Pratt's question, I really raised the issue. We're involving only two municipalities in the study. And I have to be parochial in saying Rosemont is sitting out there as one of the fastest growing communities in Minnesota. And we've also got all that Umore land that's sitting out there. And it's close to Highway 52, not far off of 35E, 35W. So I'm raising the issue, why are we only limiting it to two communities when I think there are others that could definitely play a role or have input into this study and should be considered?
Thank you, Senator Claussen. It looks like Mayor McGuire might have a word or two on that issue.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to actually defer to Mr. Atkin, but I'll respond. And Senator Claussen, I appreciate the question. Egan and Inver Grove Heights are here primarily as a catalyst to try to get this regional effort going. We're not at the point yet where we're able to reach out to public and private partners to involve them in the planning and ultimately the decisions that are going to be made. But certainly Rosemont is considered within that purview of the regional approach to the South Metro that I talked about and would be a very important participant in this. I think if you look at Blaine, a lot of the local high school hockey teams, for example, utilize that facility even though they are from once-removed communities. So certainly Rosemont and all of Dakota County and the South Metro is part of the vision. I think Mayor Bartholomew and I are here to simply get the catalyst moving and the ball rolling so that we can have further conversations with cities like Rosemont and the rest of Dakota County.
Thank you, Mayor. Commissioner Atkins, did you want to comment on this?
Very briefly, Madam Chair, I'm feeling love for the idea, which is the terrific piece of it. And I want to commend the cities of Inver Grove Heights and Egan for stepping up to show their local support for it. The idea, the genesis for the idea was actually prompted from some discussions dating back 3, 4, 5 years ago with there was the basketball community and then the Timberwolves weighed in, then the Minnesota Vikings constructed their facility in Egan. So the question went out, you know, and again, the location was so critical if you're going to attract national or international competition to be within a few minutes of the airport. So reached out to the mayors of Egan and Inver Grove Heights. They stepped up. The bigger point, though, Senator Pratt, Senator Claussen, and others that may have an interest in it, is feeling the desire and the need, the demand for that type of facility. So I'm liking what I'm hearing.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will say this. Good ideas have many mothers. And that's perfectly okay, and it is also helpful to you to have many partners because a project of this size will need that, and that's one of the reasons for having a hearing is to have that opportunity to hear those issues, bring them out, and forward. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. So it's very helpful to have this discussion. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, final word, I would like to see more people at the table, you know, from Dakota County and the surrounding area to have their voice heard. Mm-hmm. Because eventually many of our citizens in that area are going to use this facility. So having their input, I think, is important. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Pratt.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I just wanted to not only highlight the economic benefits to the South Metro that this would bring, but if I recall, Senator Claussen was a coach at one point in time, and we know how important it is to get our kids active, moving around, both for short-term and long-term health benefits. Anything we can do to get them off the video games and onto the ice or the court or the pitch is something that I think will benefit us all in the long run. So thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate all of it. And we'll have closing comments, final comments from Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief, and I'm also just realizing how much South Metro representation there's actually on this committee, so I should have realized that before I got here. But no, all points well taken. I appreciate the commissioner and the mayor's being here to shed some light on this issue and how it could be important to the region of the South Metro. I think it is important that maybe, Madam Chair, as you said, we take a chance to include more partners, get more feedback, and take a look at how this can be implemented, and I very much appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so when a bill such as this is laid over, there's no commitment to anything that's in the bill, but it's also an opportunity for you to take a look at both your fiscal note, to take a look at the partner kind of question that you have here, and so as we move forward, to use that time. Members, with that, Senate File 3407 is laid over.
Thank you.
And then to our last bill on the agenda today, Senator Dietzick, Senate File 2980. And you have an amendment, Senator Dietzick.
Yes.
And I've noticed here that it's been posted, and copies of the amendment are also being distributed for your amendment. So welcome to the committee, Senator Dietzick. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And so I'll move Senate File 2980, and then we will move the A5 amendment. This is an author's amendment, right, Senator Dietzick?
Correct.
Okay, so I'll move the A5 to Senate File 2980. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Two-year bill, Senator Dietzick, as amended, and proceed. Just reminding you about the audio record.
Madam Chair, could I just point of clarification? Did you say the A5 amendment, or is it the A2 amendment?
A5. I think it's the one that just got distributed.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, there was an A2, obviously, but the most recent version is the A5. But thank you for asking. Always good to make sure we have things correct. So, Senator Dietzick, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, everybody. Good morning, members of the committee. I apologize for the lateness of the A5, but as I have found out, anytime you start digging into Chapter 10A, it gets complicated pretty quickly. So I would just like to thank Ms. Dangle and Mr. Sigurdsson for continuing to work with me even early this morning to make those changes. Thank you for hearing Senate File 2980. So this bill deals with Chapter 10A, campaign finance and public disclosure laws. The bill was originally brought to me by constituents who were concerned that candidates filed for office, were buying ads, and had lawn signs out, but never actually registered a committee. They felt there was a lot of activity going on and that these people should file. So we currently have to report anything in our annual filings and pre-primary and pre-election filings over $200. So anytime we raise or spend $200, we have to report that. But the threshold to actual register for a campaign candidate or candidate committee is $750. So for consistency's sake, and to maybe bring that down for transparency, the original bill moves that original registration to $200. So then as we continue to look at Chapter 10A, the amendment actually then covers all the other areas related to where candidates have that $750 threshold. So the amendment ensures that there is no ambiguity and that there's consistency throughout Chapter 10A. So I was trying to find a balance between transparency, consistency, free speech, and workability. So the $750 was changed back in 2013. We increased that threshold, but that's 2.5 times what we report. And so, again, trying to find that transparency. We're not changing the reporting date, so there'll still be a lag time, but if we can get people to register, it just adds some maybe comfort to some people who are wondering, you know, why are people out campaigning and are candidates, but they don't have a registered committee. So it's just for your consideration. The constituents who brought it before me couldn't be here today, but Mr. Sigurdsson from Campaign Finance is here if you have any questions. And so that's kind of the summary of a bill in the nutshell. And I'll just stand for any questions.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dietzick, how do we, right now, how do they, and maybe this is a better question for Mr. Sigurdsson, but right now, how do we even know how much they spend? I mean, you almost have to take them to court just to find out how much they spend. If they don't ever file, they don't ever file, and I don't know if we ever go and look. So I'm not so sure it depends on what the dollar amount is in our legislation. I think more importantly, it's probably trying to find somehow to hold their feet to the fire and enforce, whether it's 200, whether it's 100. You know, if they file, maybe they should have to file a report. Maybe that's the only way to get them to actually do it without doing some extensive research and investigation. I don't care if you want to comment or Mr. Sigurdsson, however, but I think that's a problem that we currently have no matter what the dollar amount is.
Senator Dietzick, I think maybe we'll phone a friend and see if Mr. Sigurdsson can comment on that particular issue. As the executive director of the Campaign Finance Board, he has responsibility for a lot of these, has a lot of knowledge. So, Mr. Sigurdsson, go ahead when you're ready. But again, remember your name and title for the audio.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Could you speak up? You're a little soft.
Apologize. Good morning. Again, for the record, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The issue that Senator Howe raises is dealt with basically through the complaint process. It's where people see the activity that a candidate is taking, whether it be through lawn signs, other types of advertisements, because the staff, of course, isn't really aware of what's going on the ground through the 67 Senate districts and 134 House districts. It relies, the whole process in 10A relies on people on the ground realizing that there's a problem and then notifying us in the form of a complaint, but the committee is clearly not registering with the board even though they have activity that has crossed over the threshold. The point here, I believe, from Senator Dietzick's explanation is that then that would lower the level that people would be looking for registration from $750, which might allow a fair amount of activity, back down to $200, which would, in general, push registration requirement back down to the candidates at an earlier point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Senator Howe. Okay, so if I can restate that, Mr. Sigurdsson, it was still difficult to hear you. So I just want to repeat so that we can clearly understand. Is there any enforcement? I think the question was, how do we know that they have spent under 750 unless they report under 750? Because if I understand right, if they're not required to report until 750 or more, it's only at that point you actually know that they're spending money. Would that be correct, Mr. Sigurdsson?
Senator Kiffmeyer, again, with the complaint, if someone came to us and said this committee has a radio advertisement and yet they're not registered with the board could at that point then start an investigation, which would include the ability to audit records and bring in people for testimony if necessary, even look at bank records to understand what expenditures are being made by the committee. So there is an enforcement process, and it's going to be triggered, though, by people who are in a better position than staff to understand what committees are active and what have not registered with the board for a state level office. So there is enforcement, but it's going to be triggered by somebody on the ground coming to us with the possibility of an issue.
So Mr. Sigurdsson, what I hear you saying is it's on a complaint basis. So if somebody complains to the Campaign Finance Board, then you would investigate and require records from whoever the subject is and find out from there in regards to the amount expended?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I would say that generally this is not an issue. Certainly there have been complaints over the years where someone has questioned why a committee is not registered with the board. But generally, through the outreach that we have, through our education programs, through the working with the parties to provide information to potential candidates, they're aware of that requirement. And so in general, we do have registration compliance, but we do have a mechanism in place to enforce that if there's a question as to whether or not the committee is compliant.
So Mr. Segerson, in regards to those registration requirements, isn't there $100 once you've spent $100 or in order to register your campaign, you have to have a bank account? I mean, there are certain requirements that go with registration, filing your official campaign with the Campaign Finance Board. Could you explain, I think there's an amount of money that requires you to register. I thought that it was $100. Maybe it's the $750 for all I know, but could you explain the registration and the trigger for a bank account and expenditures at that point? If you can, as much as you can, really speak into your microphone. We really want to hear your answer.
Okay. I apologize. I wasn't aware that it wasn't functioning very well today. Madam Chair, the $100 threshold that you're thinking of was the one that was replaced or modified, I should say, in 2013 and increased to $750. You're correct. When the community registers with the board, they do have to identify that they've established a separate bank account with the bank, obviously, so that they have an area for collecting the funds, the contributions, and the donations from the candidate all have to go into that account so that there's no possibility of commingling, and so that it's obviously easier, if necessary, for the board to be able to audit the records by going to that single identified account. So that's part of the process. You identify your bank, you identify the officers responsible to the committee, you identify the treasurer that is responsible for keeping the receipts of expenditures and keeping track of the contributions received, and obviously eventually filing reports with the board. So that's all part of the registration process, is setting up the mechanism to be able to comply with check for 10A, both through a bank account and through the necessary officers that provide information and keep the community in compliance with the requirements of Chapter 10.
Okay, Mr. Segerson, what year was the dollar amount? It went from $200 to $750. What year was that?
2013, Madam Chair.
2013.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Segerson, did it go from, I thought it went from $100 to $750.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, you are correct. You went from $100 to $750 in 2013.
Okay. All right. So that's what I'm remembering from, is that $100 amount. Okay. And so the other question I have for you, does somebody who is a candidate who is below that $750, are they able to use the political contribution refund program?
Madam Chair, no, they are not. To be able to use the program, you do have to register a committee with the board. That's one of the requirements. So there is a basic threshold of activity required, or at least a registration requirement that must be met before you're eligible for being able to issue the PCR receipts.
So, Mr. Segerson, until they are registered, they cannot use the political contribution refund program?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. I'm restating this because it may also be difficult for our viewers to also hear the answers and want to make sure that we communicate clearly. Senator Dietzick, I'm not seeing Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. I had one question that I'm not sure if I heard an answer from Mr. Segerson, but if you are still below the $750 amount that requires a campaign committee to be formed, and Madam Chair, you mentioned about a bank account that needs to be established. Mm-hmm. If you stay under that $750 and then do go above it, is that requirement retroactive so that there's a bank account record of those donations and expenditures that are less than $750?
Interesting question. Senator Carlson. Senator Dietzick, do you want to try, or should I ask Mr. Segerson?
I want to clarify if I...
Senator Dietzick?
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to clarify if I got that right. So they can go up to the $750, and then once they have that $750, then they are supposed to register the campaign, and then they are also then supposed to report, and they have to report everything you know, they won't have to report until the pre-primary or pre-general election or their annual campaign, but they do have to report it. And so that is, that reporting is retroactive. Does that make sense?
Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that does make sense. So I wanted to make sure that there wasn't a way to hide your expenditures and your the contributions if you didn't do a 750, or so that you didn't weren't able to appeal that was, I didn't intend to go above 750, and so I didn't have a bank account.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Dietzick,
yes.
That might be a slightly different question that maybe Mr. Sigurdsson should answer, because again, that I don't intend, and that's part of the reason we brought the bill. And I agree with Senator Howe. I don't know, you do need to enforce it, we don't know, but I just think kind of, especially with social media today, having the number lower, and maybe 200 isn't the correct number, but having the number lower, people have a better idea of what, you know, are they actually spending. But that 750 number was pretty, you know, you can do a lot for 750, and so we weren't sure, and so the people weren't sure if they wanted to go through the trouble to file a complaint. But if the number is lower, you have a better understanding of, you know, what you can and can't do for, you know, 200 or even 500. And so I just use the 200 for consistency's sake, because you have to report 200. And so is that a good starting point? If you have to start reporting at 200, maybe then that's when you should have to register. So, you know, part of this is for, you know, the committee to consider. It was brought to me by constituents, and so I thought they kind of had a good point there, that if we're going to be transparent and then find that balance between transparency and, you know, being a treasurer is a lot of work. So truly trying to find that balance. So
thank you, Senator Dietzick. We have another question, Senator Howe, and then Senator Fateh.
Well, I was actually going to pass on it, but, you know, I, as I look at this, I'm thinking if the candidate never spends, the candidate spends $100 and they don't spend any money after that, but the BPOU or someone else spends money in their behalf, they would never have to register. So I don't care where, there's a hole, no matter where we look, there's a way to get around it, so.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Senator Fateh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for clarification. Is it either the contributions or expenditures equaling $750, or can both combine to equal 750?
Yeah, so good. I have the statute
Senator
here.
Senator Dietzick or Mr. Sigurdsson can answer the question. Mr. Sigurdsson, we're short of time here, so I'm just going to go to Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Senator Fateh, it's either or. So if you either raise more than $750 and or expand more than $750, either one will cause a registration requirement.
Mr. Sigurdsson, what if the two added together are $750, I think is the question.
Madam Chair, it's two separate amounts. So in other words, you could raise $600 and spend $150, and that would not require a registration. It's $750 for contributions or $750 for expenditures.
Okay, I think that clarifies it. All right, thank you. All right, members, thank you very much. We have session in about 10 minutes, so this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we've completed. Thank you, Senator Dietzick, for being here today. And with that, members, we've completed work. We are adjourned.